A federal judge has delayed the hearing for actress Lori Loughlin and her husband until next month in that college admissions bribery case. They'll appear April 3rd on charges that they paid $500,000 in bribes to get their daughters into the University of Southern California. The scandal, uncovered by federal authorities, involves dozens of people and has put a new focus on fairness in the college application process. We're going to look now at the history of college admissions with historians Brian Ballow and Ed Ayers, co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, welcome back.
Thanks.
Good to be here.
And first of all, were you surprised that there are people right now in 2019 willing to break the law just to get their kids into college?
Well, me personally, I was about as surprised as they were in Casablanca to discovering that there was gambling there. Shocked, simply shocked. And the reason I say that is, at least as an historian, rich people have gotten their kids into college for, well, pretty much the history of colleges. That is the baseline, Jeremy.
Well, take us back then to the beginning. Who were these schools originally built for, the early days of higher education in America?
And higher education begins very early in American history, 17th century at Harvard, and then lots of other schools all around. And they were basically created to create a learned clergy at first, but that rapidly expands into a learned legal profession and the other professions. And the trick was that you had to know Latin and Greek, and often Hebrew, to go to them, which gives you some idea of who they're made for. Mm. That was pretty much the story in the 17th and 18th centuries, and a lot of the 19th century, until we create land-grant colleges. 1862, the great vision of colleges for rural people, that every state would be given land on which they could build a university.
And that really distinguished us, didn't it, Ed?
Oh, I mean, it
that
did.
Was just different about America.
Well, you know, it's a great advantage of the federal system that everybody gets something. But here, you know, this is where all the techs and the states.
A lot of the state schools A&M's. Now are land-grant universities still.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, all the big universities that you think of, University of Michigan State, all those places, are land-grants. And so that changed everything. And it was meant to change everything. It was meant to say that college is for everyone, and not just people who speak ancient languages, but for people who want to be excellent farmers. And they were famously inexpensive. Relatively easy to get into, including for women. In fact, this is one of the great democratic innovations in all of American history.
And of course, there were a lot of historically black colleges that opened up at that time too, right?
Yeah, those were created in the wake of emancipation all across the South. And so you'd have people who had been born into slavery who were then going to college. It's a wonderful innovation as well. We think about Booker T. Washington. It opens the doors for all these people. So you have these parallel tracks toward democracy, and you're also having colleges for women being created at this time as well. So in the late 19th century, early 20th century, it looks as if college is going to be really something everybody can benefit from.
That's absolutely right, but everyone was really not all that many people.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? I mean, a lot of people just didn't see the reason to go to college, and one of the limiting factors that we usually don't think about, Jeremy, is before you go to college, you needed to go to high school.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And most Americans didn't really start getting high school degrees until around the time of World War II. So there just wasn't that large a pool of people who would even think about going to college, in spite of this opening for African Americans and for women.
So when did colleges start to be seen as prestigious places that you would strive to get into for a successful life later on?
Well, that's been the case all along, right? What's new is not the exclusion, but rather the great opening. And that happens with World War II and the GI Bill. I mean, this is really what opened the door for a lot of lower-class white men who would not have been able to have gone to college before, but suddenly Uncle Sam is footing the bill, and it makes sense for them to go to college.
Yeah, and it caused all kinds of disruptions. Colleges weren't used to seeing this kind of college student. It really was very universalistic within the realm of white men. And I think we both want to emphasize white men because even though African Americans served in the military and were veterans, they didn't have those high school degrees. They couldn't take advantage of this incredible benefit that the federal government was offering. And women did a lot to help the war, but not many of them qualified for veterans benefits.
And then picking up on that, the huge demographic surge of the baby boom generation, you'd see college attendance rates reaching all-time highs in, I think, 1970, 71. But as you asked, Jeremy, how did it become exclusive at the same time? And ironically, these two things are not unrelated. When it becomes common for people to get a college degree, getting a really extra special college degree
right. mm-hmm.
becomes even more important as a way of differentiating yourself.
Right. Yeah, maybe an Ivy League education. And
that
brings me to my next question.
That's one vision of special sauce.
Right.
Absolutely.
Well, and so do these elite schools like Stanford and Yale and Harvard deserve their prestigious reputations?
I think they do. If you measure them in terms of, you know, the income that you're going to make if you've gone to a place like this, people who go there make more money. But I don't think that's a great way to measure the word you use, Jeremy, which is prestige. Even if you're a lowly history professor, you're not going to make nearly as much as the petroleum engineer who went to Oklahoma State. But if you're a history professor who went to Harvard, well, then that just conveys a kind of specialness that is out there in society. I'm not in any way saying it's deserved, but I think it's a real factor.
And it's also a real factor in terms of life partners and business partners and, you know.
Your network, basically.
Your network. I mean, it matters enormously. And, of course, then you have networks within networks. So it's not enough to go to an Ivy League school. You have to be in the right dining club or.
Right. It's network, not net worth. But the two are very much related. Right.
Now, we hear a lot about how colleges today covet diversity, including the most elite ones. Do you think that that is true? Is that an illusion? What do you think?
No, I mean, we are admitting the most diverse classes ethnically and in terms of gender in American history.
And in terms of country of origin.
Well, that's right, too. We're the great magnet for international students. And here's the thing is that these colleges and universities are spending enormous amounts of money, mainly by redistributing the money of rich people who are paying full freight. A large part of the tuition of people who are paying $50,000 or $60,000 a year is plowed back into financial aid for others. And so people have recognized that you're not going to be a prestigious university if you don't look like America. You know, if you're talking about building these networks, you need to capture as much of the talent in the country as possible. And people are finally beginning to realize that talent comes in all shapes and colors.
So from a historical perspective, what should we make of this current scandal of parents bribing, paying off people to get their kids into college?
Well, from any perspective, it's reprehensible. I mean, let's just say that flat out. But I do think, Jeremy, that we pile so many expectations on universities, on education in general. We expect them to solve gigantic social problems that really are well beyond the pale in terms of what they can do to educate. And I think that we do that because there's something that is not on the table through much of American history, and that's the R word, which is redistribution. And so because we're not willing explicitly to do things that would redistribute income, wealth, and early opportunity, like where people live, where they go to school early on, we say, it's okay. This is all going to get solved by a better education system.
You know, I think one of the expectations that people pile on college universities is that it will somehow be a meritocracy. And in my best days, I believe it's as close to a meritocracy as we're going to get. But it also has a kind of a money laundering effect. What it means is that it doesn't really matter how you got there, including maybe buying your way in, but then you are seen as merited once you've graduated. So at the same time it creates prestige, it makes the prestige seem earned rather than purchased. And I think that's why this remarkable degree of outrage has met this relatively few number of people who are doing this, because it seems a violation of sort of the secular gospel of this country, which is that people deserve what they get.
They are the co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory and historians Brian Ballow and Ed Ayers. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, Jeremy.